where we left off yesterday. So we're looking at the idea of right view of the Noble Eightfold Path, Samma-ditthi, and we're looking at rebirth. As it says in the formula for Samma-ditthi, it says there is this world and there is the other world. And this means that, basically it means that there is such a thing as rebirth. There is a movement between the different worlds, so to speak. Yesterday we had a look at the sutta on the beginninglessness of samsara, the kind of eternal moving around, and what that actually means. And now I'm going to have a look at another couple of suttas which are roughly on the same topic. And then we will see, and then afterwards we will have a look at kamma after that. So this next sutta is also from the Annamattaka Samyutta. This is number 11. It's called Unfortunate, which I think is Dugata, probably, or maybe something. I'm not sure exactly what the Pali is for that one. Anyway, so this is how it goes. On one occasion, while dwelling at Savati, the Blessed One said this: "Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning, a first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Whenever you see anyone in misfortune, in misery, you can conclude, we too have experienced that same thing in this long course. For what reason? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them." So, again, just another reminder of samsara, the moving around, going from one birth to another one. It means that you have experienced pretty much everything, right? And whenever you see somebody in the world, you see somebody in, if you see somebody happy, or if you see somebody in misery, sometimes it's more powerful to think about the misery, because it reminds you of the sort of suffering that you have experienced. This is more, has more power perhaps to drive you off the wheel of samsara. So whenever you see somebody, right, and again, perhaps the most suffering that I see in this world, of course, if you look at the animal realm, you can see enormous amounts of suffering. But even in the human realm, you know, you travel around, especially always India is always a place where I see most suffering. And you see people in all kinds of states and all kinds of problems, you know, very difficult situations. And then you remember, I too have been there, right? You see these kind of very crippled people, you know, begging on the street, being in a terrible condition, looking absolutely miserable and terrible. You have been there. And if you don't get off the wheel of samsara, you will go there again, right? This is kind of the thing about this. Eventually we come under the wrong influence. Eventually not a Buddhist. Eventually do something which isn't quite right. And then you end up with suffering as a consequence. So again, very powerful. And remember that sometimes you can hear from Buddhist people, they say that, you know, this person is suffering, it's because of their past bad karma. And because of that, sometimes people don't have enough compassion for people who are suffering. It's not the Buddhist way to dismiss these things and say they have done bad karma. It's almost like they deserve their suffering, right? This is not really the right way of looking at this. If we do that, we can become very hard and very cold towards other people. That is the wrong way of looking at it. Remember, everybody goes through these things. We have been there too. We will go there in the future. It's all about just cause and conditions coming together in a bad way. It's not because you are, one person is inherently good, another person is inherently evil. We all go through badness and goodness in our lives. And so for this reason, we should never think that somebody deserves the suffering and that because they have been bad. It's always about having compassion when you see suffering for other people. And another perhaps small point, which also is nice to remember, there's another sutta also in the same Samyutta, where the Buddha says that, you know, it's very difficult to find any being in this world who has not been your mother, who has not been your father, who has not been your brother, sister, etc., daughter or son, because we have been going around for so long. So sometimes it is useful to think about that. It's actually quite a nice way of establishing metta as well. If you remember that anyone in this world has, especially if you consider, think of yourself as a mother, right? And you see everybody around you, and you have been the mother of all of these people, right? That kind of changes your perception. It makes it much more easy to forgive and to have compassion and to be kind to the people around you. It's one of those perceptions that you can use to help you develop metta in this very life. Okay, I just put that sutta in there because I thought it was a little bit interesting. And the next sutta too is a little bit of interest. It's called the stick, danda, I think it is called in Pali. And it goes as follows. At Savati, bhikkhus, this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Just as a stick thrown up into the air falls now on its bottom, now on its side, now on its top, so too as beings roam and wander on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Now they go from this world to the other world. Now they come from the other world to this world. For what reason? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all conditioned phenomena, all phenomena, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. So this... remember that there is no, again, there is no course. It's not as if we are kind of charting a course through samsara, heading in a certain direction. That's not how it works. The way it works is that if you look at the big picture of things, there is no kind of course at all. There is no sort of it's just a random thing. You go to one birth, you go down to another one, and then perhaps you become a Buddhist, so you get reborn in a nice place for a while, but then you become a bit of a scallywag and a dodgy person for a while, right? You do some bad things, then you go down again, and then you become a human. And in the long run, it's just this random fluctuation through samsara, depending on the cause and conditions that work on you. This sutta doesn't mean that it is a random way you get reborn. That's not what it means. Because obviously if you do a good karma, then the likelihood is very high you will get reborn in a good destination. If you do lots of bad karma, the likelihood is you will get reborn in a bad destination. So in that sense, that is still true. But in the long run, we all do bad karma. In the long run, we all do good karma. So the big picture, if you look at it in a very big picture, it is like this random fluctuation going on and on and on. And this is the kind of the scary thing about this, right? We are not in charge. Causes and conditions are in charge. We are subject to this. We are subject to suffering. We are victims of suffering. We are the victims of the cause and conditions in the world. And we are not really in charge of what is going on. And that is very important because it feels like we are in charge, right? It feels like I can decide my future. I can decide whether I will do good and bad. And that is, of course, the delusion of a sense of self. That's a very important part of it, the sense that we are in charge of our destiny, that we are heading in a certain direction. But that is a delusion. And actually, things just go through these cycles over very long periods of time. So keep that in mind, because that kind of, it's a bit frightening, right? It's a bit scary. But this, you know, if it is true, we still have to take it on board. So that is... the last sutta about, which I've taken out about the idea of rebirth and the kind of the feelings of samsara. And I wanted to tell you another story. It's a story that I tell, I've told quite a few times in Perth. And this was a story of a man in Perth who did what is called past life regression. Now, past life regression means you get hypnotized, and when you get hypnotized, you get kind of, you are told certain things, and then you try to kind of move into your past life. And this past life regression is very unreliable. Sometimes it comes up with all kind of crazy results, you know. So it's actually quite unreliable. But sometimes, occasionally, it comes up with some very striking results. And this was the case with this one man in Perth. He was, we have, in our Buddhist society in Perth, we have one man, very, very nice, kind of big, Australian man, and he does this past life regressions. And then we had this other young man, maybe not young, but kind of middle-aged or whatever, and he went to him and said, I would like to try this. And what happens is that he goes into this past life regression, and then he remembers all these details, right? All these details of a past life. He remembers being an immigrant coming from Ireland. Ireland in those days was very, very poor, and he comes to Australia. He remembers his name in Australia. He remembers the name of his wife, right? He remembers his children. He remembers that he lived in a house, such and such a house, in such and such a place, right? He remembers the kind of work he was doing. All of these details. And he went to two or three sessions to this past life therapist. And then, of course, he got very curious, right? I remember all these details. Did such a person actually exist? And then he goes into the archives that are available in Australia, looks into the archives, looks for the names of this person, and tries to check out all the facts. And what is astonishing to him, he was a Catholic before. He's interested in Buddhism, but he didn't really have any relation to rebirth. The idea of rebirth was kind of a bit alien to him. But he was interested in meditation, all these kind of things. And then as he started to check out these facts, kind of check, right? They're all fitting. There is such a person who had such a wife, who had such kids, who lived in such an area, who was an immigrant from Ireland, who had such an occupation. And there was, of course, a few things that didn't check out. There's always a few things that don't match. But there were so many things that it was very fairly obvious to him anyway that what he was remembering in that past life therapy was the past life of this, was the life of this particular person who had existed in Australia 150 years before, or something like that. And for him it was a shock, because he didn't believe in rebirth. And he said initially he was in denial, he didn't want to know about this. And then over time, over the weeks, over the months, reflecting on this, doing more research, going back to another session with the past life regressionist, eventually he came to the conclusion there has to be such a past life. It has to be true. Because too many things fitting. It cannot be a coincidence that is going on here. I don't know. Maybe it can be coincidence. Maybe it can't. It's very hard to know. But it sounds like, certainly sounds like this is not a coincidence. We're having Mara playing tricks with us here. So this was a very fascinating case, when there's so many little points that fit in, right? And somebody who beforehand doesn't really believe in rebirth, they find themselves forced to change their view because of the amount, the number of incidents that kind of fitted into this picture. But that was not the most interesting thing. The most interesting thing was even more profound than that. The most interesting thing was that when he remembered his past life, he saw himself as this poor migrant coming from Ireland, right, having nothing, coming to Australia, and then deciding, I'm going to build up my life from scratch, right? He had nothing. So he goes to this large property in the south of Western Australia. He becomes a farmer, and he's a very successful farmer, and he builds up his whole life, you know, into this big farm. And when he eventually comes to his deathbed, he's going to pass away, he looks back on his life, and he feels a sense of pride, right? I have made it in this life. I started with absolutely nothing, and now I have built up something beautiful. And he felt a sense of pride at the energy and commitment that he had made in this particular life. But then the interesting thing was that in this life, he's also a businessman. In this life, he has also started a company from scratch, right? In this life, he is working with the mining industry, and he has some kind of product that he wants to sell to the mining industry. And he's very driven, right? Working very hard. And he had always had this feeling that, you know, this is my choice, right? To work hard, to go out there, to sell this product to the mining industry, to become a successful businessman. This is my personal choice. This is something that I really want to do with my life. It feels like I am doing this. But then, when he saw into his past life, and he realized that in his past life, he had been doing exactly the same thing. He had also been this person who was driven, who wanted to business, who wanted to succeed. And he
he understood for the first time that the reason why he's acting the way he's doing in this life is not because of his personal choice. It's not because he wants to go out and make money and kind of build up a business. He saw for the first time that the reason is because that was his character in his past life. And he's carrying over that character trait from the past into the present life. He was like a robot. He was like a computer running on a program that was written in the past life. And now he's playing out that program over and over and over and over again as a consequence of the conditioning in the past. And he said when he saw that, it felt terrible. It felt like he wanted to give up his whole business. It felt like I have no control of my life. That's what it felt like. I'm this kind of machine, just moving along according to cause and conditions in the past. And he said at that point, only thing he wanted to do was to sell his business, get out of there and become a monk and do something else with his life. That is the power, right? This is what it means to see past lives. It means to, and this is only a very tiny little thing compared to seeing past lives in a real way. This is a very small thing. But you see the selflessness. You see how causes and conditions are always forming you. How you don't have much choice. How you are not deciding how to live your life. And how you are, in a sense, a robot running on a program that was written sometime long, long, long time ago. And that is kind of very, very eye-opening here. And I really enjoyed that story. I thought it was very powerful because it shows us a large part of what the problem is in life and why life is very different from what we think life actually is. We feel in charge, but actually we're not really in charge at all. Okay, so that is just a few things about the idea of rebirth. And this last question, this very last thing here, is not really about karma, it's just about how our characters develop over time. We create habits, right? We become very habituated, we do things in a certain way. And I, after hearing that story, I always, when I feel that I become, you know, I feel that my habitual tendencies come up, you know, you get upset about something, or you feel desire about something, or you get into sloth and torpor, whatever it is, or you do too much work, or whatever it is, you feel these old habits arising in you. And I always reflect now that this is probably a habit that I've been carrying with me from a long, long, long time into the past. And that makes me feel a sense of urgency. I have to overcome this habit. If I don't overcome it now I have the opportunity, now I'm a Buddhist monk, now I understand these teachings. If I don't take the opportunity now, right, when am I going to be able to overcome these bad habits from the past? It gives me a sense of urgency when I reflect on the past in that way. Otherwise, I will keep on carrying on. With me into the future, the same old stupidity, the same old ignorance that I'm under the influence of right now. Okay, so now let us have a little bit of a look at karma and the idea of karma. And I'm sure the main idea of karma is very clear for you already, the idea that our ethical actions in this life, if you do unethical things, it has negative results. Karma is basically very simple. All karma means is that unethical actions lead to suffering in the future, right? To painful experiences, difficult experiences. Good karma leads to happy results in the future. That's really all it means. It's very quite a simple idea. But the actual workings out of karma, how it works in the larger scope of things, is a little bit more complicated. And one of the problems about karma, there is a lot of misunderstandings, I think, of how karma actually works. Lots of myths are about how karma functions. And it's good, perhaps, to, if we can, perhaps later on, we can talk a bit about those myths and how what the Buddha actually teaches in comparison to what people often think about karma. But anyway, let's start off with this particular sutta. This is called the Kukkura Vatika Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya 57. And kukkura vatika, kukkura means dog. Vatika is like you're taking on a vow, right? You're taking on a certain habit, a certain behavior. So you're taking on the dog behavior, the dog vow. And that is why it's called the dog duty ascetic in English. From the Majjhima Nikaya, it's quite an entertaining sutta in some ways. And it is the Buddha having a discussion with these two ascetics. One practicing the life of the dog, the other one practicing the life of an ox. And the way they act, they try to act exactly like a dog, right? So he lies down on the ground. When people give him food, he eats the food straight off the ground, right? Like a dog would do. And then at night when he goes to sleep, he curls up like a dog, like you see the dogs lying on the road around here, you know. That's how he sleeps. And then, of course, he asks the Buddha. He does this because he thinks that this kind of practice will lead to something positive, will lead to good results, to a good rebirth or to Nibbana or whatever. And then the Buddha tells him that, well, you know, if you keep on practicing this dog duty ascetic, it will probably lead to you becoming a dog, right? That's what it means. And because you're actually developing the habit of a dog. You're actually becoming a dog in your mind. And if your mind becomes like a dog, well, that is where you go when you become reborn. And then this dog duty ascetic, he cries, becomes really upset. He doesn't want to become a dog, right? Nobody wants to become a dog. And then he kind of ends up by thanking the Buddha for kind of showing them the right way. And I think eventually I can't remember whether they become monks, but something good happens in the end anyway. But part of this, so it's a nice little sutta, and a part of this sutta is the Buddha setting out the four kinds of karma that he has realized by himself. And this is actually quite interesting, these four types of karma. And this is the extract that I have taken out from this particular sutta. So this is how it goes. Punna is one of these ascetics, right? I think that's Punna is the ox duty ascetic, I think. Yeah. Punna, there are four kinds of action proclaimed by me after realizing them for myself with direct knowledge. What are the four? There is dark action with dark result. There is bright action with bright result. There is dark and bright action with dark and bright result. And there is action that is neither dark nor bright, with neither dark nor bright result. Action that leads to the destruction of action. So now we will look at each one in a bit of detail. And what, Punna, is dark action with dark result? Here someone generates an afflictive bodily formation, an afflictive verbal formation, an afflictive mental formation. I will explain in a second what this means, because this is not very obvious, perhaps. Having generated an afflictive bodily formation, an afflictive verbal formation, an afflictive mental formation, he appears in an afflictive world. When he has reappeared in an afflictive world, afflictive contacts touch him. Being touched by afflictive contacts, he feels afflictive feelings, exclusively painful, as in the case of beings in hell. Thus a being's reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed. When one has reappeared, contacts touch one. Thus I say, beings are the heirs of their actions. This is called dark action with dark results. So this, in a sense, you can see here the Buddha says this, you become the heir to your actions, right? Kamma dayado. Kamma dayado is this kind of standard phrase you will see in the suttas. And here it is explained what that means, that you are the heir of your actions. So let's have a look at this in a bit of detail. This then concerns dark acts, right? Bad acts with painful results. The kanha, dark. So you generate an afflictive bodily formation. That means basically that you do an act which causes pain. You do an act which comes from a defiled state of mind. That's basically what it means. An act that causes pain. And sometimes, you know, that when I see translations such as this, then I feel that there's always a little bit of room for improvement, because not very few people can actually really understand. It doesn't really, it's not something that you think, wow, oh yeah, that's very clear. You don't feel that when you see that. You feel more like, what exactly does this mean? And this is, I think, the purpose of the Dhamma should be that it is transparent, that people can actually understand what is going on, because these are practical teachings that we're supposed to put into practice. And so for that, it should be quite transparent what the meaning is, without distorting the meaning, at the same time, be as transparent as possible. So here, somebody does an act by the body which causes pain, an act by speech which causes pain, or even an act by mind, in a sense, which causes pain in a certain way of the, in a certain manner of speaking. Then, having done that, so this is the bad karma, right? You're doing the bad karma. Having done that, you reappear in an afflictive world. And of course, because you are reappeared in an afflictive, in a painful world, painful contacts touch you. And by being touched by that, you feel painful feelings. Now, one interesting point, which is a little bit beside the point here, but which is interesting here, is that what you are seeing here is really dependent arising, paticca samuppada, in practice. This is what you're seeing here. If you know the Pali behind these things, you will see that it is almost exactly following the dependent arising. So here you are seeing a practical example of how dependent arising functions. So the afflictive verbal and bodily formation here is sankhara, right? So you create bad sankharas. This is the second factor of dependent arising. As a consequence of the bad sankhara, you reappear in an afflictive world. In other words, your vijnana, which is the third factor of dependent arising, your vijnana is established in a painful existence. You see, in the suttas, you have this idea of the vijnana titti. Vijnana titti is the... titti means being established, standing in a certain place. So the vijnana becomes established in a certain place, right? As a consequence of your sankharas. And because vijnana is established there, the nama rupa of that existence is part, becomes then established. A certain... Nama Rupa basically is the four other aggregates, right? Is the feelings you have, the perceptions you have, the consciousness you have, and also the will, the volition that you have. Now these things depend on where you get reborn. So if the vijnana establishes itself in a high place, the Nama Rupa is going to have certain characteristics. If it is established in a low place, Nama Rupa is going to have other characteristics. So Nama Rupa depends on the station of consciousness. And part of Nama Rupa is the Salayatana, the six sense bases. And then you have contact, right, which is mentioned here. So once you get reborn in a certain existence, vijnana establishes itself there, then certain contacts will touch you. And these are, in this case, the painful ones. And from that contact, you then get feeling. Right? So feeling then is the last thing here. And then you experience feelings as a consequence. So this is interesting, just as a side point, that this is all really about dependent arising. And it shows you that the step from sankhara is actually a step of rebirth, that it shows you here quite explicitly in this particular sutta. So you reappear as a consequence of that, and you reappear in this place. So this is dark action, experiencing dark results. And the example being used here is like being reborn in hell. So dark act here, dark action with dark results, means very dark acts. It means acts of hatred, acts of intense desire perhaps, but especially acts of hatred leading to such a very bad destination in the future. So that's what dark means, right? In this case, very, very dark. It's on the dark side of things. So let's have a look at the bright side. And what puna is bright action with bright result. Here someone generates a act with the body that causes happiness or doesn't cause pain. An act with the by speech, which doesn't cause pain, or which causes happiness, an act of the mind, which doesn't cause pain, but which causes happiness. Having generated such acts, he reappears in a place which is happy, or a place where there is no pain, an unafflicted world. When he has reappeared in an unafflicted world, unafflicted contacts touch him. Being touched by unafflictive contacts, he feels unafflictive feelings, exclusively pleasant, as in the case of the gods of refulgent glory. Thus, a being's reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed. When one has reappeared, contacts touch one. Thus, I say, beings are the heirs of their actions. This is called bright action with bright result. So here you have the opposite. Here you have the bright, this is called the bright actions. What is the Pali word for this? Sukha, isn't it? S-U-K-K-A. Sukha, yeah. So these are the sukha actions. The kanha was the previous one. And here you can see what is meant here by bright actions. Sukha actions are the very, very pure actions. You get reborn in a place where you experience exclusively pleasant feelings. So this is equivalent to the jhana realms. And the gods of refulgent glory, these are Subhakinna Deva, is that right? Subhakinna? Yeah, Subhakinna Deva, something like that. So these are, it's like equivalent to the third jhana, and all you experience is pure, undiluted happiness, nothing but bliss upon bliss upon bliss, continuously. So this is the happy experience, right? So the dark acts are the acts that lead you to rebirth in the very most painful existence in hell realm. The happy, the bright acts are the ones that lead to rebirth in the jhana realms. So what about everything in between? What kind of act is that? Is that bright? Is it dark? What is it? And this is kind of the interesting thing here. Very often when we talk in Buddhism, we talk about karma being either good or bad. But according to this, the bad acts, they lead you to hell, and the good acts, they lead you to rebirth in the jhana realms. But for most of us, when we do a good act or do a bad act, it doesn't lead to hell or it leads to the jhana realms. It goes somewhere in between. And this is kind of the interesting point here. And this is why the third aspect here is quite interesting here. So, so the third aspect here. Yeah, let's just go straight to that one before I say anything more. So let's look at the third one. And what, Puna, is dark and bright action with dark and bright result? Here, someone generates or someone does an act by body that is both causes pain and causes happiness. He does an act by speech that causes both pain and happiness. An act by mind that causes both pain and happiness. Having done these kind of acts by body, speech, and mind, you reappear in a world that is where there's both pain and happiness. When you reappear in such a world, you are touched by contacts that are both painful and pleasant. Being touched by these, you feel feelings that are both painful and pleasant, a mixture, mingled pleasure and pain, as in the case of human beings and some gods and some beings in the lower worlds. Thus, a being's reappearance is due to a being. One reappears through the actions one has performed, and when one has reappeared, contacts touch one. Thus, I say, beings are the heirs to their actions. This is called dark and bright action with dark and bright results. So what does this mean? And what it means, as far as I can see, just going by the suttas and not going by any other interpretation, it means that most of the acts we do, they are neither bright, entirely bright, nor are they entirely dark. Most of the actions that we do are somewhere in between. They are like grey, essentially, right? And sometimes they are like a lighter shade of grey, sometimes they are a darker shade of grey, but most of the actions we do are actually grey. And when you think about it, you probably know that that is true. How often is it that you do an act which is absolutely pure, right? You have this complete, full loving kindness for everybody around you, and you just generously give of yourself completely to every person on this planet and every animal or whatever. How often is that? It is very rare. It is maybe only after a state of samadhi that you're able to give and to act in such a way. These acts are very rare in the world. And also, how often is that you act from pure hatred? You feel such strong hatred, right? You just want to go out and kill everybody, or something like that. That too is very rare. It is very rare that we have these very powerful emotions, either on the high side or on the bad side. Usually, we are somewhere in between, right? You do an act, okay, you do an act of generosity, so that is good. But maybe when you do that, your mind isn't fully pure. There are still some defilements there. Maybe you think that, well, I will do this act, and maybe I will get some good results in the future, right? It's just human to think like that. There's nothing wrong with that. But what it means is that the action, the generosity is not pure, because there's some degree of desire involved with that act. Only when you give 100% without expecting anything in return is it an entirely pure act. So most of our actions are like that. Or if you do something bad, right? Very often it is not entirely bad. There's very often some kind of redeeming quality to the acts that you do. I'm not sure what a good example might be, but for example, you steal something, right? There's many, many different ways you can steal. You can steal simply because you're completely greedy. Or for example, if you are a mother and you have a child which is hungry or whatever, and you steal something out of compassion for your child. These are very different things. So it depends on how we steal. What is the motivation that lies behind the actions? These are very important things to remember. And this is what determines whether the act is very dark gray, light gray, or entirely white. What is the motivation? What is the thing that drives the action that you're doing? So karma, when we, I often get this kind of question. People ask me, is this good karma or is it bad karma? And the answer is, probably it is somewhere in between. It is like kind of grayish. Very often karma has this kind of gray kind of quality to it. So our job then, as on this path, very often we don't have a choice. We're not able to make entirely bright karma all the time. So our purpose then on this path should be to try to make karma which is slightly less dark than karma we have done in the past. Try to move up the spectrum, so lighter shades of grey, right? That is often the best we can do. We cannot expect to make entirely pure karma all the time. So you make karma that is less dark than before, a lighter shade of grey than before, and then you're heading in the right direction, and then you make that grey grayness, you make it lighter and lighter and lighter, until one day you're able to make that absolutely pure karma, which is basically going into the deep states of samadhi, etc., etc. So this is what comes out of the sutta, and if you think about life, that is how we experience life as well. How do you experience human life? Human life is not like you experience, this is perhaps one of the things to be aware of. It when it says dark and bright results, it doesn't mean that you experience like very terrible feelings and then very, very happy feelings. Most of the time we feel something in between, right? It's kind of neither very good nor extremely bad. It's somewhere in between. So dark and bright here means something in between. It doesn't mean like up and down very rapidly. It means somewhere in between. So that is our experience, and also the experience of how we create karma, or the kind of intentions we have, is also the same. You look at your intentions, where are they? What drives them? You understand that they are somewhere in between. So this fits very well with our experience as human beings. So this is some of the what comes out of this particular sutta, the idea that karma is actually very complex. And this is very useful to think about. I will maybe talk a little bit more about this later on when we talk about right action and right speech, because it means that right action and right speech also has many different degrees. There's no such thing as this is absolutely wrong speech, this is absolutely right speech. Well, sometimes there is, but usually it's somewhere in between. Same thing with action, right? Sometimes an act of stealing is very bad. Sometimes an act of stealing is not so bad. Sometimes an act of killing is very bad. Sometimes it's not so bad. Sometimes an act of generosity is extremely good. Sometimes an act of generosity is not so good. It all depends on the motivation, the things that drive us. So it gets much more complicated than normally we think. And the only way you can decide on the kind of karma that you are making is to know your mind. The more pure the mind is, the less defilements you have, and the more purity you have in the mind, the better the karma is going to be. So really you have to know the mind. What is the motivating factor that lies behind this? This is called the hetu. Hetu in the Pali Suttas. The hetu is like the cause. What causes these things? And in the Anguttara Nikaya 3, you see this. The hetus for the performing of good karma is the lobha, dosa, moha, is the hetu for bad karma, and for good karma is aloba, adosa, amoha. Motivation is really the clue for understanding karma. If you find this, my explanation, confusing, then it is not perhaps not surprising, because there's many things that I've been explaining fairly quickly here. I don't want to spend too much time on this. I just want to give you some idea of the complexity of karma and karma vipaka. And then comes the very last one of these kammas that are explained in the sutta, which is also quite interesting. And what puna is action that is neither dark nor bright, with neither dark nor bright result, action that leads to the destruction of action. Therein, the volition, the will for abandoning the kind of action that is dark with dark result, the will to abandon the kind of action that is bright with bright result, and the will to abandon the kind of action that is dark and bright with dark and bright result. This is called action that is neither dark nor bright with neither dark nor bright result. Action that leads to the destruction of action. These are the four kinds of action proclaimed by me after realizing them for myself with direct knowledge. So this is the last kind of action, and this is essentially the kind of action that the Aryas do, the noble people do. This is the one where you understand that you don't want to continue on in samsara. You don't really want to be reborn again. So this is the action which leads you to the end of rebirth, the end of producing more sankharas. This is what this is all about. And if you're not an Arya, you can only approximate this. You cannot actually get there 100% because you don't really fully understand what the ending of rebirth and the ending of all these things, what it actually means. So this is really only the kind of action, as I understand it, that the Aryas can do, and we can only approximate this kind of action. So whenever the Aryas are practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, this is essentially what they are doing here. And one of the important points here is that if you do this kind of action, it leads to the destruction of action, right? It leads to the ending of karma. Karma gets destroyed. And that, of course, is an important thing. Sometimes, we were talking about that the other day, the idea that when you sit with pain in the body, then we are destroying the karma of the past, right? And by destroying all the karma of the past, we are somehow freeing ourselves from that karma. But that is not really a Buddhist teaching. That is a Jain teaching. In a few suttas, like the Karajakaya Sutta, that sutta seems to be influenced by certain Jain teachings. So that's why there's a certain Jain feeling to that sutta. And it has been shown by scholars that sutta is actually probably has been influenced by Jain teachings. The way you show that is by comparing such suttas to the parallels existing in other languages. And when you do that, you can show that there is a difference there. Something has happened in the sutta that it has become distorted. But what we're seeing here, this is really the Buddhist idea, right? The Buddhist idea of overcoming bad karma is not by experiencing its results, so that it can be kind of come to an end through experience. That is not the way. There's two ways in which we overcome our bad karma from the past. And one of those ways is explained in the famous lump of the salt simile found in the Anguttara Nikaya 3, the Tika Nipata, I think Sutta 100 or 101 or something like that, Lona Pala Sutta. And that is a fairly well-known simile, but just in brief, the idea of that simile is that when you do good actions, when you practice this Noble Eightfold Path and you live in the right way, you are diluting the effects of bad actions. So bad actions you have done, they're not abandoned, they're not destroyed, but they have much less scope for causing you pain in the future. They are diluted. So an act that might cause an ordinary person to be reborn in a bad state, for the area, it will just be a little bit of pain and a little bit of discomfort in comparison. And the simile there is that if you take a lump of salt, right, a grain of salt, a large grain of salt, and you put it in a glass of water, it doesn't use the word glass of water in the sutta, obviously. It uses some, I think it uses a, I can't remember now what it is, but let's just say a glass of water. The idea is still the same. Now, that, what happens then is that that water becomes very difficult to drink. It is very, very salty. Why is that? Because the salt, which is the bad karma, signifies the bad karma. The water, which signifies the good karma, the bad karma is large compared to the good karma, and therefore the result is very bitter. Right? You experience a lot of pain as a result. If you take the same amount of bad karma, the same grain of salt, and you drop it into a large body of water, in the sutta it says the river Ganges, but this says something large, like a pond or something like that. Maybe you can taste a little bit, but only a tiny little bit, right? Why is that? Because the bad karma is the same, but the good karma, which is signified by the water here, is much, much greater, and therefore the taste is very small in comparison. So this is how you overcome bad karma in Buddhism. Not by experiencing all the pain you can, and I would encourage you, if you have any doubts about this, the Buddha actually criticizes this very idea of experiencing pain. This is in the Devadaha Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 101. He has a conversation with the Jains, and this is quite funny. He goes to the Jains and he says, well, you know, if you are experiencing so much pain, perhaps it is only because you have done so much bad actions in the past, right? That now you are experiencing all this pain when you're sitting on the rocks completely motionless. So is that the reason? So the Buddha is pointing out that it doesn't make any sense in this case to talk about this as the result of karma. If the Jains have done bad karma, if karma is the reason why they have experiencing pain, it must only be because they have done much karma in the past. But really, they are creating this suffering for themselves in this life, and it's not really related to karma at all. It wasn't very well explained by me, unfortunately, but if you have a look at the Devadaha Sutta, you get the idea of what is going on. That's Majjhima Nikaya 101. So this is the Buddhist way then. We dilute the bad karma by doing good karma, and then the bad karma has much less scope for arising and causing pain for us. And then we keep on diluting it until one day we come to this point here, and where we start to do actions that are neither dark nor bright, that have neither dark nor bright results. And then what we're doing, we are going even beyond the dilution effect, where we actually destroy the ability for karma to bear fruit in the future. And that is why the arahant, right? The arahant, when the arahant passes away, he doesn't get reborn, right? And then, of course, all the karma that the arahant had done in the past, all that becomes defunct. It doesn't work anymore. It's no longer able to bring forth fruits into the future. And this is what the arahant does. So this is how it works in Buddhism. It is the dilution, and then the ending of karma is actually how it works. So this is another important point. It is one of these things that I think is important to point out, because there is a lot of misunderstanding in the Buddhist world with regard to these things. Okay, so the next thing that I want to talk about here is something slightly different. So I'm not going to go on to that now because we only have a few minutes left. But because we have a few minutes left, maybe I could just briefly talk about some of the other things in Kamma, which are, in my estimation, are important to keep in mind. And these recently, with a good monastic friend of mine, known as Bhante Sujato, we did a course in Perth called Kamma and Rebirth in Early Buddhism. We did it over a fairly long period of time, and we talked about Kamma and Rebirth in a fair amount of detail. And in the first, we had like workshops, and they went on for many hours, one workshop a month. And in the first of these workshops, we looked at the myths of Kamma and Rebirth in Buddhism. And we called the first work, this is Adan Sudhar, this is Bhante Sudhar, not my idea, he called it myth-busting, right? We're going to bust some of the myths that are abound about these kind of issues. Some of these myths are worth thinking about and worth actually looking at. And one of the myths that you often hear in Buddhism is that people go around saying, oh, it is, this is my bad karma. I have this, this is the result of my bad karma. Something happens in your life and you say, oh, it's my bad karma. It's like an explanatory principle whereby we explain the problems that we have in life. But actually, it isn't really your bad karma, right? This is one of the things about Buddhism. We tend to ascribe everything to karma. But the Buddha doesn't say that everything we experience in this life is due to bad karma. This is not the way it works. In fact, the Buddha says if everything was due to bad karma, everything was due to what we had done in the past, then it would be impossible to live the brahmacharya, to live the life to the end of all suffering here. He explicitly says that. And there are sruttas when the Buddha says that there are a large number of reasons why we feel happiness while we feel suffering. And he mentions illness, right? You would think that illness was karma, right? But most of the time, or a lot of the time, it's got nothing to do with karma at all. It's just that if you are a human being, that's what you can expect. Illness is what happens to human beings. This is part of what it means to be reborn in this life. He mentions assault, being assaulted. He mentions the circumstances and nature, the kind of things, the weather, all the things that happen in this life. And almost everything that you can normally expect as a human being is not karma from the past. It's just an aspect of human nature. And I think it is quite useful to remember this, that a lot of the things that happen in the world have got nothing to do with karma. It has to do with being reborn as a human being. And sometimes, we have things like like the tsunamis they had in 2004 or whatever it was, when 150,000 people died, and I know Sri Lanka also was affected by that tsunami. The worst place was Indonesia in Banda Aceh, very, very badly affected, and whole villages were wiped out, right? And then how do we explain that from karma point of view? Does it mean that everybody who was there had exactly the same bad karma? They all had to die together? Doesn't make any sense, right? Maybe a few people had bad karma, but everybody who was there, whole families disappeared, whole villages disappeared. Was it really a village of all evil people in the past, and everybody had to die at the same time? It doesn't make any sense. The point, rather, is that sometimes, if you are a human being, you just die early. That is what it's like to be human, right? Sometimes you have an accident. Sometimes you get an illness. And sometimes this is the nature of being human, that you die early. If you have done bad karma, that may cause you to die early. But sometimes you can die early regardless of that. And this is how suddenly these things, like this big natural disaster that we see around the world, they start to make much more sense when you understand that it is not necessarily due to bad karma that these things happen. And when you read the suttas carefully, like the Chula Kamma Vibhanga Sutta, which talks about that, you will see it actually fits quite well with how things are described there. But you have to read it carefully to be able to see that. So that was one of the myths that we had a look at. From my point of view anyway, that is certainly a myth of how we look at the world. Another interesting one, because, and this is one of the myths that I think is also important these days, and this, you know, as many of you, maybe all of you know, is that, you know, a few years ago, we also established bhikkhunis in Perth, and we had an ordination of bhikkhunis. And for that, kind of the ideas of equality between the genders has been something at the forefront of how we have been looking at things in Australia. And it's important. In Western society, the equality, gender equality, is a very important issue. And if you don't take these things seriously, you don't get taken seriously as a religion, as Buddhism either. So one of the myths in Buddhism, which is another myth, is the idea that being reborn as a woman is the result of bad karma, right? Sometimes you hear this, you get reborn as a woman, okay, you've got to strive hard so you can become a man in a future life. And then, I don't know if this is common in Sri Lanka, I'm not sure about that, but I know it is common in certain other Buddhist countries. Right? But there's no evidence for that in the suttas. This is like one of those myths that have happened, and maybe come as a consequence of many other teachings, like the idea that to be a Buddha you have to be a man. Even that is a slightly suspect teaching, but I won't get into that now. But the point is that there is no evidence for that, right? Bad and good karma is about being reborn in different realms. And perhaps also it is about being reborn in the human realm in a very high state and a very low state. But the difference in happiness and suffering between a man and a woman, you know, who are reborn in roughly the same area, same place, is very, very small. To say that that is due to karma, there's basically no evidence in the suttas, nor is there any evidence in rational thought to believe that that is the case. So what that means, it frees you, right? I mean, if you're a woman, it's important to be freed from some of these things, because otherwise you might get a slight inferiority complex if you hear these things. You may think that I can't do it. But please don't think that. If you are born as a human being, everybody has the same capacity to practice this path and reach awakening. It's very important that everybody has that sense of confidence in themselves. If you lose your confidence, either because you're a woman or because you are born in certain conditions, maybe low status, or perhaps you think you haven't got enough education, all of these things are irrelevant. It is not about these things. It is about how you apply the path. This is what give rise to the results in the end. Okay, so those were some of the myths. We had a long list of about 20 myths that we looked at that time, but I think that is probably all that we have time for now. So I will leave it at that, and then we'll see you again this afternoon.